Welcome to A Magical Life, Health, Wealth and Weight Loss. I'm your host, Magic Barclay, lead practitioner at Holistic Natural Health Australia and number one best-selling author. In this podcast, I aim to give you practical tips on how to accelerate and sustain your health, increase your financial, spiritual and emotional wealth, and to look at something that haunts many of us needlessly, weight loss. In some episodes, I'll have guests available to give you even more tips, but in others, the floor is yours. Drop us a line at A Magical Life Podcast on Facebook and let me know what you would like to know more about. Now, sit back and enjoy, because it is time for you to create and truly discover a magical life. Welcome back to A Magical Life. I'm your host, Magic Barclay, and I'm joined by Coach John McLernan today. Now, Coach John is a weight loss coach, an emotional eating expert who himself has lost 100 pounds. So that's about 50 kilos. From nanotechnology researcher to Navy Marine engineer to globe-trotting nomad, Coach John spent most of his time running from his true calling until one question changed his life. He's now on a mission to help others lose weight for good and leave BS diets in a rearview mirror. With Freedom Nutrition Coaching, he marries the science of metabolism, the psychology of behavior change, and the compassion of human connection to create life-changing transformations with his clients. Welcome, Coach John.
Hey, thank you so much. It's great to be here. And it's so awesome to hear an Aussie accent again, because I really felt like Australia is a second home for me. I'm married to an Australian, and we've lived over there, and we've been together for 15 years. So I love it when I hear an Aussie accent. It just feels like home.
Great. Now, listen, I have to ask you, what was the one question that changed your life?
I'll give you a little bit of backstory. So, it was when I was living in South Africa that I went through some trauma, and we can dive into that if it's relevant, but the fallout from that trauma was essentially I became a binge eating food addict. And so the byproduct of that is I gained a whole bunch of weight, about 130 pounds. And so prior to that, I would have thought anyone who was overweight was basically just lazy or undisciplined. But after I turned to food as a coping mechanism, because I wasn't really equipped to deal with trauma, I found myself kind of wading into this murky world of weight loss and diet culture. And so I had a lot of failed attempts at trying to lose weight. And I wasted a lot of time and energy trying to find answers in all the wrong places. And so it was when I hired this coach back in about 2017, who really shone a light on the glaring problem that was staring back at me. And so the question was, he said, Jonathan, if you make a list of all the things you love and value, how far down that list do I go before I see your name? And so that really jarred me, because it was actually challenging this belief that I held about myself. It was challenging the relationship I had with myself. You see, really because of like all of my failed attempts to lose weight, I could say I'd even become very angry and spiteful towards myself and my body. And it's like I'd repeatedly tried to punish it into submission. And so he was working with me to really heal my relationship with myself, and then by extension, food. And that was a real, could I say, a seismic paradigm shift for me, that I could actually treat myself with love and compassion and lose weight. And so it was really that shining that light on this. If you don't change your relationship with yourself, nothing's ever going to change. It's like trying to put a Band-Aid over a gaping wound.
I just got a few wow moments there. I actually did literally fall off my chair while John was talking because definitely that list idea, yeah. While you were talking, I was running that through my head. And, you know, I talk a lot on this podcast about what I value and about my golden values. So the things that I strive and live for being, you know, animals, the environment, natural health, my family. I think I'd probably get to about number 30 before my own name pops up. That's just like, that's why I fell off the chair.
Yeah. Well, the truth is for me, I wasn't even on the list. And that's why this was such a, like, it was really, I would say he delivered it very well. It was a very well-timed question, but in the moment, it was actually also a very confronting question. because it was really challenging my very like worldview, this entire belief that I developed that I wasn't worthy of love, care, and affection from myself. And that was spilling over into my relationships and interactions with every other person. So here's what I had to figure out. How do I start to love myself? What does that even look like? And I'm a male, and in masculine culture, we don't talk about self-compassion and self-love as a general rule, or we don't see that spoken about. Where do I even start? And so that question really stirred up a lot in me as I was trying to figure all of this out. And, you know, I saw compassion as like weakness, when in fact, really compassion, well, maybe I could put it this way. So I used to beat myself up a lot. And it's like beating myself up was a way of relieving some of the guilt I would have experienced around maybe having a binge, for example. Compassion is actually another way to relieve the guilt, but where beating myself up would move me backwards, compassion could actually move me forward, because it's actually seeking to understand the behavior without judgment. And when we can understand the behavior and where it comes from and why it occurs, then we can actually create change.
Oh my gosh, that is a light bulb moment. We're only a couple of minutes into the podcast. And listeners, let's just recap that. Look at what you've done with compassion, not with guilt. That just reframes the whole situation, doesn't it, John?
It really does. It's been a monumental shift. And the truth is, I find myself working with probably 90% female clientele. I'd love to work with men. You know, in fact, I had another coach say, you know, I'd love to create a podcast geared towards men and try and talk about what you're talking about, but I'm not sure it's going to get off the ground. Like, so it still speaks to this shift that needs to occur. But compassion is such a challenging concept for us to, I think, because it's been misunderstood. So maybe I could illustrate it this way. Well, let's just say I came across you, you know, maybe I came over for a cuppa or something, and it's halfway through the day, and you got a bottle of wine in your hand, and it's half empty. So if I was to say, oh, magic, you know better than that. Why are you doing this? That immediate judgment that I just created there then creates a sense of guilt and a desire to retreat and hide the behavior. So then what it means is, in the future, rather than change the behavior, what you're actually going to do is you're going to try to hide the behavior. And that's your brain trying to avoid the discomfort of feeling a sense of guilt. Now, on the other hand, if I was to come to you and go, ah, well, you know, you had a hard day. You're already halfway through that bottle. You might as well finish the whole thing off. That's called enabling. So that's not going to move you forward either. That's just going to reinforce repeating that unhelpful behavior. So compassion really looks to walk the middle road between those two and says, hey, how's your day going? What happened? How'd you get here? And so it's this curious desire to understand. And I like to say that all behavior makes sense. And I don't mean that all behavior is ideal or helpful, but I think if we can understand how our human brain works, we can make sense of our behaviors and why we do it. And then the compassion, by releasing us from the guilt, is what allows us to move forward. And so I like to say I create space for my clients to, in a sense, wrestle with their demons in the light without judgment. And that's where we can create change.
Couldn't agree more. Now, John, I ask my guests the same three questions, and I'm always fascinated with the different answers, the different takes, the different angles that we get on these. So I'm going to fire them at you for this episode. And then in our next episode, I hope you will rejoin me and we'll talk more about creating lasting change. Is that okay?
Absolutely. Love it.
Great. So the first question is, what can your expertise do to accelerate health? Now, when we're talking health, we're not just talking the physical, we're also looking at the emotional and the spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all of these things are tied together, right? And so when we see an unhelpful behavior pattern in one area of your life, that pattern is probably being repeated in other areas of your life because there's a deeper internal cause to that. And so what we want to do is, we don't just want to address the surface behavior. We want to look at why that behavior exists and where that pattern has come from. And when you can create that internal shift, it's no longer you're trying to force yourself to do something against the internal resistance, but now you're working with yourself. And as that shift is created, it doesn't feel like you're fighting against who you are to become this person you want to be.
Perfect. Now, what are your top three tips to creating wealth? We're talking not just the financial, but the personal and emotional.
That's an interesting one. So the first one is, I like to say that awareness is where we create change. So only 5% of our behavior is really conscious, about 95% of it is unconscious. If we want to create change, such as creating wealth in our lives, we first have to become aware of the behavior patterns that exist. So awareness is the first step to change. The next thing we need to do, though, is make a decision to create change. But there's a little joke that goes something like, there's 5 frogs sitting on a log. 4 frogs decide to jump in a lake. How many frogs are sitting on a log? Well, there's 5. Making a decision doesn't mean you've done anything. It's just you've now decided you're going to take some action. And so then the next thing you really want to do is, if you're going to invest time and effort into it, you want to have some kind of strategy. In other words, you don't just want to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. You want your actions to be deliberate and meaningful. And so what I'm really trying to illustrate here is, if we want to create change, and creating wealth, in a sense, we're trying to create change from a pattern we're currently stuck in. There's really kind of a logical sequence that we want to follow in a step-by-step fashion. And that's exactly like what I try to do with my clients in my program, Lifestyle 180.
Great. Now, you were talking about the frogs on the log, and I think we need to draw that out a bit. So with people's health and with creating wealth, people are often the frog on the log, right? Yeah. And they make a decision to go on a diet or to eat better or to go for a walk every day. And listeners, remember I spoke to you about morning routines and why they're important back at episode 83. But just making the decision doesn't do it for you. Now, off air, Coach John and I were discussing something that we've both learnt through different avenues. And I was saying, as a coach myself, I find it very hard to get coached because I can't coach myself. I'm not unbiased. I am completely biased, and I'm completely slack and not with compassion am I coaching, but I'm enabling most of the time, or with guilt. So, you know, it's a bit like the painter who never finishes painting his own house, but he'll go and spend hours and hours making masterpieces in other people's homes.
Yeah.
So I guess, how can the listeners become the frog that takes action from the log? What are some really easy steps once you've made the decision to actually action that?
I think the first thing, I really encourage my clients to set what I call a CMG, a can't miss goal. The reason for this is, if we try to create too dramatic of a shift, our brain will resist because it's too far from our current sense of identity, who we see ourselves to be. The other thing is, when we want to cultivate a habit, the easier the behavior is to repeat, the more likely it is to stick. And once we've established a behavior pattern, we can always build, grow, nurture, and expand it. And so let's just use movement, because that's a simple one. We'll use that as an example. So for a CMG, I would say maybe set for 5,000 steps a day. Now, some people might say, well, that's not 10,000 steps a day. What's the point? And I would say, well, what is a goal that even on your worst or most difficult day you can likely hit? It's probably not 10,000 steps a day, right? But you can probably hit 5,000 a day. What's required is maybe a small amount of deliberate movement to make sure, on top of, you know, the regular amount of movement you get just going about your day-to-day life, you require a little bit of deliberate activity to make sure you hit that mark. But the more times you can repeat that behavior, the more likely it is to stick and the more likely it is to become automated. So in the beginning, when we want to create change, we get really excited because we're picturing in our head how we're going to feel, what we're going to look like, what life's going to be like when we accomplish this change. But we try to, I like to ask the question, well, how do you eat an elephant? And the way that we go about it, the real answer is one bite at a time. But we try to swallow the elephant whole. And the elephant is a metaphor for a very large problem that we're facing. And the truth is, the solution to a problem we're facing does not have to be equal in magnitude to the problem. In other words, you don't have to swallow the elephant whole. And so this idea of setting a CMG, or a can't miss goal, something so simple that even on your most difficult day, you can hit that mark, that means you're going to establish a pattern of behavior that's much more likely to stick.
Totally, totally agree. Now, we mentioned a little bit earlier about, I have to come back to this again because I really want the listeners to get this, about the road, with compassion being in the middle. You know, many of the listeners, I guess, have people enabling them, have people making them feel guilty, not just themselves. So how do people seek coaches or their support group that will give them that compassion?
That's a, truthfully, that's a hard thing to find. Even to, it's the shift is happening, but it still can be a challenging thing to find even in the coaching space, because a lot of us do what's called projection. So for example, you know, when I was at the sort of the height of my struggles with my weight, and I would see my wife eating a chocolate bar, it would make me angry. Now, I wasn't getting angry really at my wife. I was angry at the fact that she could eat a couple of squares of chocolate and put it away. Whereas me, I would feel this urge or this compulsion to eat the entire bar and maybe go scrounging around trying to find more chocolate. So I was seeing my own struggles and imperfections, projecting them onto her and seeing them reflected back at me. And that was making me angry. But really, before we can find that from somebody else, we have to be able to find it within ourselves. And could I say, in a sense, we instruct other people how we want to be treated by how we treat ourselves. That's not a guarantee that everyone's going to treat you nice. I don't mean that. But we instruct other people how we want to be treated by how we treat ourselves. We show people the behavior that we're willing to tolerate with the behavior that we direct towards ourselves. And so when we begin to show ourselves compassion, when we no longer tolerate, you know, beating ourselves up or speaking negatively about ourselves and so on, that means we're more likely to then, for example, my wife used to call me the Tin Man. And it was because I was so used to suppressing, pushing down difficult emotions. As I started going on this journey of self-love and self-discovery, I started then speaking up and saying, my wife's an Aussie anyways, so the Aussies can speak kind of bluntly, but you know, she had to speak to me pretty bluntly to be able to reach me when I was the Tin Man. But as I started to become more sensitive and more in tune to the emotions that I felt, I had to start speaking up. And when she would talk to me in a really blunt fashion, say, hey, I don't appreciate that. Here's why. Now, of course, I would do that politely. I wasn't looking for a fight, but I had to show her, here's how I'd like you to treat me versus how you have been treating me or needed to treat me in the past. So it starts with ourselves. And then as we become comfortable and familiar with that, we can then begin to guide others and show them how we want to be treated as well.
Thanks for sharing that. Now, obviously we talk about weight loss. You're an expert in emotional eating and, you know, lasting weight loss by addressing emotions. But what we find with many weight battles is that stress is the key. I myself am a cortisol junkie, and it has left me with extremely high cortisol, a big problem with my weight. So my question is, if you've ever battled your weight, which we know you have, what was your trigger to lose it? And also, what can you offer the listeners to reduce their stress?
What was my trigger to lose it? I don't think there was any one thing, but it was probably a series of small shifts. So I was probably on the verge of a nervous breakdown. So I was trying to train 2 hours a day. I was running a bricks and mortar business for maybe 14 hours a day. I was like sleeping 5 hours a night. And when my body wasn't losing the weight the way that I felt it should, I was then using like pre-workouts and stimulants like caffeine and ephedrine and things like that, that all they're doing is they're redlining the nervous system. And so it got me to the point where I was then suffering from anxiety and panic attacks because my nervous system was so burnt out and stressed. So I had to then take stock of all the different stressors that I was experiencing in my life. So there's a term called allostatic load. So if you're familiar with what a bell curve looks like, I mean, it's just actually a curve in the shape of a bell. And as you go up one side of it, it's like, you know, your stress increases. And when you reach the top, that's like the peak amount of stress or the ideal amount of stress. We do need some stress in our lives. It is our impetus to do things. Without it, without cortisol, we die. So we need some cortisol. However, the way that our 21st century world and lifestyle goes, most of us are vastly exceeding our ability to recover. So we're going into what we call allostatic load, more stress coming in than going out. So stress relief is not going to happen passively. Stress reduction is not just going to happen by chance. In the modern 21st century world, we actually have to deliberately practice it. So for me, I really started to militantly prioritize my sleep. And I made this agreement with my wife. I said, look, I have to focus on this. My wife is a night owl. You know, she would stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning every night. That's, you know, that's how she is. But I said, look, this is what I have to do. And here's why I have to do that. So we began to militantly prioritize my sleep. I cut out all stimulants for a period of time. So no coffee, no chocolate, nothing with caffeine in it, which is really tough. But it was easier to go without the stimulants than it was to deal with daily multiple panic attacks. I then took up meditation as a practice, and really, really simple. It wasn't, you know, there's no burning of incense or going to monasteries or things like that. It was literally using Insight Timer and setting it for 3 minutes and putting some white noise in and practicing a couple of breathing exercises. So I was actively doing the things that would activate my parasympathetic nervous system, the branch that deals with rest and digest. And I was reducing the things that were triggering or stimulating my sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight. So it isn't that there's necessarily one trick, but rather if you look at all the things that are stressing you out and you go, which ones of these are negotiable or optional and how can I reduce them?
Yeah, that's great. And we have talked about sleep hygiene before on the podcast. So I think that's really great to remind the listeners that that's your first step, because when you have, I guess, let me say, your cortisol awakening response on the wrong cycle. So in layman's terms, you can't get to sleep at night. You're wired and tired. You're lying in bed going, yeah, why can't I sleep? But in the morning, you can't get out of bed. So that's the opposite of how it should be. In the morning, you should, you know, the alarm goes and you should bounce out of that bed ready to go for the day. And then, you know, as dinner approaches, you're starting to get a bit more tired. You're calming down a lot. You know, you might watch something on TV or whatever, but you've got kind of no reaction and your body tells you, you know what, it's time to go to bed. You go to bed, you don't remember what you are reading. The book is next to you when you fall asleep, because that is what is supposed to happen. That is the correct cortisol awakening response. And many of us have that back to front, or we have spikes during the day, which is that often that, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon coma.
Yeah.
It's not always blood sugars. It's often cortisol. Well, which is a sugar. And, you know, sometimes mid-morning, smoko time, as it used to be called here, you can just either get, you know, a buzz of energy all of a sudden, which is not where it should be, or you feel that fatigue. So a proper sleeping pattern, good sleep hygiene, gets that cortisol awakening response back where it should be.
Yeah. Our cortisol normally, it's cyclical or rhythmic. And so in an ideal scenario, what we kind of see, and you could see historically, this would normally follow the rhythm of like daylight and darkness. So as the light, you know, because human beings, you know, pre-100 years ago or a little more, didn't have electricity and electric light. And so it's like when it's dark out, it's dark out. And so as the sun would come up, it would signal to start producing cortisol. And that cortisol, as it begins to come up, elevates you out of sleep into wakefulness. And so we need that increase in cortisol to bring us from our sleeping state into our alert and wakeful state. So that normally that would happen maybe say between 5 and 7 or 8 a.m. kind of thing. And then we normally see a dip happen a couple of hours later around that 10, 11 a.m. mark, which is incidentally where we put smoko or coffee break or whatever we want to call it. And that tended to align with when we see cortisol dipping. It would then pick up. And then we also see another bit of a dip in the afternoon, which again corresponds with roughly the afternoon coffee break that we would see people take. And then it kind of comes up again, and then it starts to fall off in the evening. And as the darkness settles in, we then start to produce melatonin. And melatonin is not a hormone that keeps us asleep, but it helps prepare us to fall asleep. And if cortisol is elevated, it's a real struggle for melatonin, because they're inversely proportional. So as cortisol goes down, melatonin goes up. If melatonin goes down, cortisol goes up. And so this is why even maybe supplementing with melatonin, while it can sort of be helpful, some people say, well, I took melatonin, it didn't work for me. And I was like, well, yes, because your cortisol was still elevated. So you're artificially elevating your melatonin levels while your cortisol levels are still through the roof. And so in that case, it's not going to help you. So if we understand what a normal rhythm is supposed to look like, we can then try to take steps to restore that.
And back when I spoke about morning routines, I told the listeners that getting out in the early morning sun helps the bacteria in your gut create that melatonin and the right neurotransmitters to help with your sleep routine. So getting out there, you know, early morning hours, grounding, getting your feet in the soil, getting some sunlight, even if it's winter sunlight, just helps you with that sleep pattern. So there's a lot that people can do that doesn't cost anything that sets them up for a good night's sleep.
Well, you know, it's interesting just thinking about things that don't cost you anything. Meditation, if we could capture all the benefits of meditation and put it into a pill, we'd have a $1 trillion pill. And yet it's free. And it can be done really simply. It doesn't require anything. You don't have to have an app or a smartphone or anything like that. Literally just sit somewhere and focus on your breathing. And when your mind wanders, you bring it back to counting your breathing. It can be that simple. So it's, but there's this interesting quirk in human psychology where when something is free, we tend not to value it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I've had the opportunity to bounce around your website a little bit this morning. I guess there's a question with weight loss that many women face, which is probably why you're getting so many female clients, but men can also face it. So with women, menopause strikes. Now, men, guys, you're not out of this. You have andropause.
Yeah.
So I guess with menopause and andropause, the weight gain is in a different area. So it's often low abdominal, right across the colon, so you can't expel toxins properly because there's too much weight pressing the colon. How does what you do address that change? Because so many weight loss programs and weight loss coaches are just for the pre-menopause, pre-andropause set.
Yeah, so this is something really interesting because here's the thing. A menopause or andropause is unavoidable. It's going to take place in our life. But we often see, I think sometimes this unfairly gets blamed for this when it tends to correspond with as we get a little bit older, we tend to move a little bit less, we tend to, you know, and so on. So there is an element of this hormonal shift that's taking place in the body that does make it a little more easy to store food as fat, maybe a little more difficult to lose some fat. But it's not, we can't put all the blame on the shoulders of this hormonal shift that's happening, nor can we necessarily avoid it from taking place. What we can do is we can create the conditions in our lifestyle that, let's say, make it the best possible experience. And it doesn't mean it's going to be fun. Imagine me, a 40-year-old male, trying to say to a woman, oh, you can make hot flashes just fine. No, that's not going to work quite like that. But what I want to allude to here is we can perhaps influence the severity, the intensity, the frequency. So we actually, our hormonal environment is not entirely outside of our influence. We can take steps and actions that will at least within a given set of circumstances, optimize our hormonal environment. And it is things like sleep hygiene and stress management and quality nutrition and regular movement. So there isn't really this shift that when you hit menopause or when you hit andropause, that all of a sudden you have to do things differently. All the same healthy lifestyle behaviors still apply. You just might be against a little bit more resistance in terms of trying to create this change. And it means that maybe we need to pay a little more attention to recovery, to rest, and to stress management, more so than trying to do the high intensity activity, the heavy weightlifting and things like that.
Thanks for that. That's really helpful. So, John, I'm going to wrap this episode up. And I'm so glad that you're joining us again for the next episode. And we can really dive into more about freedom of nutrition. But for now, people can find you at www.freedomnutritioncoach.com. You also have a mentorship site, which is www.johnmcclernan.com. That's John with no H. And we love to offer freebies to our listeners here. So what's a freebie that people can find or that you can send to them to get them started with you?
Yeah, I have an ebook called Crush Your Cravings, and it really explains in detail some steps that you can take to navigate cravings, everything from the first aid response to a more long-term approach to navigating, managing these things. And so you can go to freedomnutritioncoach.com/book. And I think we can put that link in the show notes as well, but it's just my website, freedomnutritioncoach.com/book. You can sign up there, name, email address, and I'll email you a copy of Crush Your Cravings.
Fantastic. Thanks for your time on this episode. Listeners, this was your episode 90. We were talking about brain-driven weight loss. In 91, John rejoins us and we're talking about creating change that sticks. For now, listeners, thank you for your time. Go forth and create your magical life. Thanks for listening today. Please subscribe to hear future episodes, leave a review, and share this podcast. You can follow us on Facebook at A Magical Life Podcast or at Holistic Natural Health Australia. That's holistic with a W. You can find us on Instagram at Holistic Natural Health or at www.holisticnaturalhealth.com.au. That's where you'll access all sorts of articles, freebies, and more.